history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you that have some pretty interesting stories to tell. And each week we get to hear them here on this program when we meet members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a whole lot, like we're going to do today in Morgan Hill, California, with 95-year-old Houghton Sawyer. Now, I emphasize 95 because you're not going to believe it when you hear him talk. I won't ask you what your secret is just yet. I'll save that for the end. But tell me about your childhood growing up in Alameda, California. What do you remember?
Oh, I remember the scouting programs I was in, particularly the Sea Scouts, which we obtained a boat from the Navy to use for Sea Scouting. We usually went after school to the base, cranked up the engine, and went out in the bay to help the Coast Guard finding logs and helping find people who were lost in the bay.
And you were just a teenager?
Yes. We learned how to do dead reckoning and a lot of the other sea-type activities that we were taught by both the Sea Scouts and the Navy. And it looked like I was prepared to join the Navy when and if it was necessary. And I lived in a Alameda High School for the 4 years that I needed to go to high school. I was in the ROTC as part of the high school activities.
So this is all pointing toward a long career in the Navy.
It was. Unfortunately, the way things happened, I did not join the Navy. I did apply and get accepted into the Navy, but unfortunately, my application was lost. So when I got on the bus to go to boot camp, my bus driver said, "Where's your papers?" And I said, "I don't know. You should have them." They didn't have them. So they said, "Well, come back Monday and we'll let you reapply." I had already been allowed a rate in the Navy as a captain to a fast boat. Unfortunately, I also was drafted on Monday. The draft board would not hear anything about my Navy interest, so I had to appear on Monday morning to be drafted. I was drafted and sent to Monterey as a starting soldier. I was rated for a staff sergeant in the ROTC in high school, so they very kindly made me a private first class. So I was sent then to Camp Santa Anita, which was a converted horse race facility in Southern California, for training. And I was training in there for a number of things. I got through basic training in the Army, and then I was asked if I would teach optics because I had already been to college for a while and I had some experience in optics. So I taught optics to the soldiers for at least 5 classes.
And explain to people listening today in 2015, they might say, "Optics, what is that? What is it you're teaching?"
I was teaching them how optics work, that is glasses and particular mirrors, and how the observatories use mirrors for astronomic observations. It was a very interesting thing. It was a 1-week class, mostly to show the soldiers how to use field glasses and other opticals, which are part of the Army.
You're talking about your start in the Army. You were drafted in December of 42, but something happened in December of 41 that changed the world a little bit. I like to ask every veteran about that day, December 7th, 1941. Where were you and what do you remember?
I was in Lake County with my grandmother in a house that she was building, and I was building part of it for her. She had it all built, but it was necessary to finish it inside. And I was on vacation from college, and I was spending that vacation to help her with a house in Lake County, and I heard over the radio that there was a major problem in Hawaii. And that was the time that I was then concerned with where I was going to go in the future. And of course, I wanted very much to be something other than a foot soldier. I was convinced that I should apply, and that's where I wound up applying for the Navy, because I did not want to be drafted. As it happens, I was drafted, as you heard. I taught optics in the first effort that I had in the Army service. When I was there teaching optics, I had the opportunity to apply back for college in a program called the ASTP. So I applied, thinking I'd never make it. Well, to say it shortly, I did make it. The first place I went after I was accepted into the ASTP,
which is Army Specialized Training Program, so at universities all over the country, they had Army enlistees, or guys that qualified for this program, actually basically just taking college classes to prepare yourself, and the theory was you'd go ahead and finish that program, right?
Right. In order to get assigned to a university, you had to go through a testing program. I had already finished over 2 years of college, so I would only qualify for upper division, and my science was electrical engineering. So I was sent to Moscow, Idaho, for qualification purposes. Anybody can imagine what it's like nervous-wise, waiting after you had finished all of the testing they did, waiting to see what your name would appear on the bulletin board as accepted. So I looked, as all did, and I finally said, yes, you're qualified for upper division engineering. Remembering that my home is in Alameda, I was looking for what college I would be sent to. Guess what? I was sent to the Stanford University. And I have never had anything that was better in my life than that 1 year I spent at Stanford in upper division electrical engineering.
Most of the guys I've talked to who ended up in that ASTP, wherever they were around the country, at some point they got word, hey, guess what? This is over because we need bodies in Europe. Is that what happened to you too?
No, it wasn't. I was in electrical engineering, and it turns out to be electronic engineering, and I was sent to a place called Camp Kohler, which was in Sacramento. The reason being they had to figure out where they were going to send me. In electronics, I then was shipped to Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, where the electronics was really invented, if you will, by the Army, and that's where I went to school to learn all of the Army electrical apparatus.
Well, and I'm sure a lot of people out there are thinking, okay, what kind of electronics were there in the 1940s? Because today, every kid you walk by has that little phone in their hand that does everything anyone in the world could do 70 years ago and more. What kind of technology did you have access to, and what kinds of things were you working with?
We work with radio apparatus, which was used for communication between units on the ground, and it was also other electronic apparatus that was used for communication over long range. And so that was really, you had to learn the rudiments of how electronics worked. And we actually had much better knowledge, having been at Stanford, than what you would start with as a basic training in Fort Monmouth. So most of the Fort Monmouth training had to do with the various apparatus that were used for communication in the Army, so that you would be qualified to go into the field and operate or fix any of the apparatus that was out there.
Just a blind question, not having seen what you did or talked to any guys who did exactly what you did. There's so many different jobs in World War II with 16 million Americans serving. Was any of the work you were doing, was any of the equipment you were working with secret at the time, or had some kind of proprietary nature that not everyone was privy to?
Well, this was only the start of my experience in the service in electronics, because I learned something about the apparatus. And then I was sent to Camp Crowder, Missouri, where we learned how to operate radio transmitters, radio receivers, and the apparatus that was called the central control. That gave me an experience in high-power radio communication, which is really intended for a long range, and that prepared me for something very special. The very special things had to do with the intercontinental communication between places in Europe and the Pentagon. I did get sent to the AT&T company in New York City to learn equipment called single sideband system for teletype transmission at 60 words a minute continuously 24 hours a day in secrecy so that they could communicate between vehicles traveling on the Autobahn in Germany and the Pentagon and managed to do a great deal of control between the Army management and succeed in knowing exactly what was happening by the minute.
Can you explain to us in layman's terms how that technology worked? Because I think that, I mean, today with a cell phone and all those satellites up there, it makes sense. But I don't know if people are grasping how that would have worked in 1944.
Well, a radio transmitter is how we used to communicate in our radios at home. And what you get is you get two sidebands if you want to refer to how the transmitter works. In this particular equipment, which was brand new for that World War II period, the single sideband had a depressed carrier so that the carrier did not use much energy. The sidebands could then transmit different material. On both sidebands would not be the same as they would on a regular broadcast. So the two sidebands could carry separate transmission, and each sideband did carry six channels of radio type double mod, which took 12 frequency channels on each sideband, giving you 24 channels of radio teletype running continuously at 60 words a minute between the communicon and wherever the transmitter was located.
So how are you entering in that communication? As the example you gave, from the Autobahn to the Pentagon, if you're in that Jeep on the Autobahn, how are you transmitting this message?
The automobiles or trucks that carried the transmitters were low power, like maybe 50 or 100 watts, and they were indistinguishable from personnel carriers, so the radio traveled with the people who were soldiers traveling on the Autobahn. Those low power transmitters and equipment then communicated with the fixed station, which I ran. The fixed station then transmitted between where it was and directly to the Pentagon or to a radio station in Washington, where then it communicated with the Pentagon.
Are these encoded messages?
All encoded messages. They were carried by a thing called SIG-SALI, which was a kind of encoding that required knowledge of what was being sent in order to decode it. So it was difficult for anybody to break the code.
So you mentioned a second ago, you were at the fixed station, and you served at a few different fixed stations in Europe during the war, right?
Two. One in France and one in Germany. The one in France was near Paris. It was in the city of Les Essarts, which is 30 miles southwest of Paris. And it was out in the country, so there was room for lots of antennas. They were large. They were very high on poles and very large in distance in order to set them up. They were like a diamond, only let's say 100 feet long on both sides in diamond shape. And they were that shape in order to send the radio wave in the right direction so it could be reflected from the ionosphere into the receiver in the Washington, D.C. area. And there were stations throughout the world, Hawaii, France, Germany, Casablanca, and we were going to put some in Japan, but we didn't have to.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we'll try to understand some of the science, pretty cutting edge at the time, that 95-year-old Houghton Sawyer was working with 70 years ago. You can see what he looks like now and what he looked like then at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 95-year-old Houghton Sawyer of Morgan Hill, California. He served during World War II with the 3798th Signal Multi-Channel Radio Teletype Detachment. He described for us one of the giant radio antennas they would use at their fixed radio outposts, transmitting encoded data from the war front in Europe back to the Pentagon. Did those giant antennas ever make you a target? Seems like that might be pretty easy for the enemy to spot.
Well, the poles are not visible very much, and the wire that is guided by the poles are not visible from a distance. As a matter of fact, these installations were not put in place until they were safe. So when I served in a place away from any activity. As a matter of fact, the war was over when I was on the high seas, and I was sent to these radio stations as replacements for those that had served for so long.
So you told us how the message is transmitted toward your fixed station, but when you're at that station, what are you receiving? What are you seeing, a printout? Are you hearing something audibly? What is it that you're bringing in and passing on?
The same very things that are sent from the truck are retransmitted exactly as they came. The message that we got was sent from the truck to the center where it was processed and then sent on landline to our transmitter site, so that there were 3 elements to this: a receiver station remote from the 2 others, the transmitter station, and the central station that processed the information and sent it or received it. So the process involved 3 locations, and the encoding was done in the center.
So when you receive this, is this a series of sounds? Is this a printout of a series of characters? How exactly does that work?
We receive exactly what is retransmitted. So we received the secret codes in teletype transmissions.
So you would get like a printed out grid of characters in a certain order?
No, we got no printing whatsoever. It was an audio line from the center which carried exactly what was to be transmitted. It's teletype code, which is 7 characters for a letter, and these were processed so that letters were transmitted at 60 words a minute. If you can imagine a 5-letter word with 7 characters per letter, it's a lot of, and it is difficult to even try to understand, because now you have 6 channels and they're being transmitted with 6 more channels for what they call double mod, so that the fading is not synonymous with the fading that I get on a higher frequency. So the 2 frequencies are working together so that the signal doesn't fade. Now you've got two sidebands, or twice the amount of transmittal that you'd get if you had a regular transmission.
Pardon me if any of these questions are ill-informed here. So you're just hearing a series of tone, of and just hearing that, you don't know what it means.
We don't know anything about what's on the wire.
But you're able to relay that exact series of tones to the next station and so on and so forth till it reaches the Pentagon.
Yes.
How did you feel about that kind of duty? Was it interesting to you? Did you feel some responsibility there?
Well, obviously, we felt very strongly that we wanted the signals to get there. So keeping the transmitters going was the main object. And we had to change frequency day and night, and sometimes different, because of the skip. In the terms of those days, it wasn't a satellite that you bounced off of. You bounced off the ionosphere. And the ionosphere, it changes position every few hours.
Some people might not know what the ionosphere is. Why don't you explain that science to us?
The ionosphere is a ring around the Earth with ionized air, which is like a cloud, except that it's thick enough so that it causes the radio waves to reflect from being irradiated from the ground. It'll reflect like a mirror back to Earth. Only the distance that it takes on the other end is adjusted so that it's long enough to go from nearly 3,000 miles away.
So are those calculations that you had to make?
No, that was all done for you, but we had to change frequencies in order to adjust the distances depending on where the ionosphere was at the particular time.
Be honest with me. Clearly, you're an intelligent man, and you had studied this quite a bit. But when you were over there operating this equipment, did you really understand how it worked, or did it seem a little out there to you?
It was absolutely known exactly how it worked, because we had to fix it. If anything didn't work, we had to get it going as fast as possible. So we knew how to adjust the transmitters. We knew exactly what was on them, and we knew how to repair any of the problems that occurred. Besides the single sideband equipment, usually we had many other transmitters because of the business of dealing with lots of other locations. We had north and south transmitters, which didn't really work the same way as the ionosphere did on the east-west. So those transmitters were different. And we had anything from 2,000 watts to 60 kilowatts.
Well, a few things come to mind for me here. Is that technology, and maybe you don't know the answer to this, maybe you do, is that technology that the enemy also had, or is that a capability unique to the Americans or the Allies?
The technique was unique to the Americans, and the Germans were the ones that were defeated in trying to figure out how it worked. As a matter of fact, because of this kind of transmitting, we could radiate right on top of their carriers and broadcast while they were broadcasting. So we could actually inject comments, and we did.
You said that with a bit of a smirk on your face. What kind of comments did you inject?
Whenever anything was said to the public in German, we could inject a counter situation which would tell the public in Germany that things were different than what they were broadcast, lying by the Germans.
So the German civilian population would actually hear what you guys were saying, and they would hear it in German?
Yes, we didn't do it. The people who were authorized to do that, and this wasn't something that was done regularly for any reason except propaganda.
So this would be the OSS types, or some propagandists that are using your equipment to send these messages to the people who are in post-war Germany?
More than likely, it would be the kind of broadcast that you would expect people to get as a general public, telling them about the news and the other things. And the only thing that we could do would be comment on the same time at the same transmitter. So they would not know that we were commenting on their comments for their public.
So what would someone on the receiving end of that hear? Would they hear both simultaneously?
We would be transmitting as though we were in a conversation with that person sitting in the same room. We didn't do much of that. That wasn't the main object of the equipment, of course. The main object was to keep communication with the Army and control out of the Pentagon.
Sounds like you had some fun with that particular aspect of it, though.
Yes, we did.
And I asked you earlier if there was anything, you know, secret about what you're doing, and it sounds like, as you described, that this was unique to the Americans, that this technology was something that during the war needed to be protected. Have you found out since the war, or are you aware of the nature of some of the messages that were sent back to the States via this technology, either while you were there or before you were there?
No, I was not privy to any of the messages that were carried. And it's just as well, because these things had to be kept as secret as possible. So it was turned into secrecy as soon as it was possible to do so.
Have you ever wondered about that? What kind of messages might have been passed on, and what relevance they had in the bigger picture of the war?
I've thought a lot about that, and it is quite expected that Mr. Patton, this is not at the time I was there, but when he was traveling on the Autobahn, he was communicating with the War College in the Pentagon. So they had a way to communicate exactly what the best plans were for their next move.
And again, I don't want to read too much into anything or put any words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're saying without this technology, there's a possibility that that war in Europe might have unfolded a little differently. I mean, everyone knows about the Battle of the Bulge and all the things that followed in 1945, but without that ability and the speed at which he could communicate back to the generals in Washington, that maybe some things might have happened a little differently? Is that fair to say?
Very fair statement. It's likely that the communication that I spoke about was key to making this thing as fast as it went.
And maybe even, for instance, the Battle of the Bulge, because there's an example where it was the response and the speed at which other American and Allied units got there that enabled them to push that back and win that eventual victory. And if that communication hadn't occurred in that kind of speed, maybe a lot more Americans would have died, or the Bulge would have turned out differently.
Well, I'm sure it would have. Absolutely certain that the communication that we experienced, that was invented by the AT&T and privately required their teams to operate it, it would not have worked as well.
It probably saved a lot of lives.
No doubt. It's a little hard for me to comment on that because I was not there during the fighting of the Battle of the Bulge. But the way the system worked, it was obvious that this was a major contribution to the disposition of all the troops.
And it's an aspect of the war that I would guess most people listening right now have never heard of before. I know it's 70 years later, but knowing what you know about what most people didn't know in 1945, does it make you wonder what kind of technology is being implemented and taken advantage of out there right now?
Oh, yes. I have lots of experience since the war in electronics, and many of these were having to do with electronics that were used today on aircraft and Navy ships in order to conduct a high communication of all sorts. I worked on a system called a Mark 86 gunfire control system for the Navy, which could see 100 miles away and could differentiate between 10 targets and figure out which one was the worst and shoot it down. I worked for a consulting firm that worked for the Navy, and this was for Lockheed in Plainfield, who invented and did this equipment. I worked with that for nearly 10 years.
Well, you always did have that dream of getting in the Navy, huh? Was that close enough for you?
That was very good. I worked a lot in the ships that were involved.
Let me ask you with regard to World War II, because you had wanted to get in the Navy right off the bat. You end up drafted into the Army, and that's, you know, late 1942. You've got all of 43, all of 44, most of 45. The war's still going on, and you're going through the ASTP and different training sites. Was there part of you that wanted to get overseas and be a part of it? Were you at all disappointed that once you got to Europe, the Germans had surrendered?
No, I was most pleased to work on something that was electronic, because that was the way I really was bent. I think the most wonderful thing that happened to me was the education I got at Stanford University. I'm a Cal graduate, and I had to be both California and Stanford, but the people at Stanford, the teachers, were those people who invented all these things.
You brought up your ties to both Cal and Stanford. I got to ask you, when the big game comes along, who do you pull for?
Usually California. My mother and my father, my brother, my sister, my aunt, and my uncle were all graduates of Cal. I was the only guy that attended Stanford, but I met some of the greatest people on earth at Stanford.
Well, and Stanford has one of the top teams in the country this year. The Cardinal took care of Cal in the big game. Mr. Sawyer has gotten to watch quite a few of those installments of the big game, but he might have missed the last 70 of them if not for a life-saving twist of fate that he'll tell us about when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. If you're an RVer, you've probably heard about the new line of Grand Design fifth wheels, travel trailers, and toy haulers. What sets Grand Design apart is the long list of premium standard features you'll find on the entire line. You'll also find the largest selection of Grand Design RVs at Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a reminder today that with 16 million Americans in uniform during World War II, there were a lot of duties we might never think of. In the case of 95-year-old Houghton Sawyer of Morgan Hill, California, it was the special training he received through AT&T to operate a radio teletype outpost capable of sending encoded messages halfway across the world by bouncing radio waves off the ionosphere. He explained some of that science, and I know we have a few more eye-opening stories to come. And I guess you were there in Europe when the war in the Pacific ended, right?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we were putting a team together in Europe that was going to be sent to Japan, and this was a 60,000 watt mobile radio system, multi-channel radio teletype, to be used in the Japanese theater.
So that would have followed the planned invasion of Japan, and then you guys would have set that up?
Exactly that way.
So you're probably not too disappointed that you didn't have to go?
Not disappointed at all.
Very real possibility that a message or multiple messages concerning Japan's surrender pass through your station in Europe, right?
It could have. I don't know that it did or didn't, but it could very well have. There were, as I pointed out in the beginning, there are a number of stations throughout the world, so that the single sideband communication was worldwide and easily understood, easily put all of those people who were authorized together at one time to discuss issues.
Well, do you remember when you heard the news that Japan had surrendered, and did that mean anything to you?
It meant I was going home pretty soon.
That's good news, right?
Yes, you bet it was very good news.
What about your interactions, if any, or impressions of the civilians you encountered in Europe, whether it was the French people who were freed by the Allies or the Germans who maybe didn't realize it at the time but really had the Allies to thank for their freedom too?
The French people and the German that I knew were all very good people that I would welcome in my home. The French people, I had a cook in France, and he wound up trading with the French people for good food. The fact that we lost shoes and coats and other things, we never asked questions. But we had fresh eggs and fresh milk and good food. And our food was served in Quonset huts, and we were cooked in gasoline stoves, and usually it was cooked in a garbage can. But in France, it wasn't, because we had this cook who was very anxious to get decent food for us.
Quite a luxury. As the war in Europe came to an end, and in the final couple months of that war in Europe, the news that kept coming out was one concentration camp after another is discovered, is liberated. And people are starting to become more and more familiar with what had happened to the Jewish people and other political prisoners there in Europe. Did you get to see any of the aftermath of that up close?
No, I did not see anything of the camps. When I was in Germany, we had our location was in a place called Marbach Kasern, in a town that was a long distance from where the terrible places were, where they killed those Jewish people. I did see one of the schools where the Germans took their young children, their boys, and took them away from the family and put them in a school where they were taught all of the things they wanted the soldiers to do. So there was a very bad feeling that I had, where most of the kids didn't have a life like they should have had.
So you saw a school where there were still kids there, or you saw an empty school but were told what had happened there and the brainwashing that had occurred?
I was told most of it. I didn't see any school children anymore, but I saw the schools.
And just being there at a school and knowing what had happened there turned your stomach?
Yes, definitely. That was a very bad thing to do for any group of people.
Is there anything else about your time in the service that's memorable to you, that you think is important for people to understand today, since most of the people alive today didn't live through World War II and they don't know how close we were to a very different existence?
When I got to Europe, I landed at a Le Havre. I went overseas in a troop ship. I landed there, it was a mess. Le Havre was loaded with ships that had been sunk. The railroads had curled up rails because of the bombs. We were billeted in tents, and these tents were named things like 20 grand. We lived in a place where Europe was different than the United States, and we all soldiers had to learn a lot about Europe. And I guess most people do, whether there's a war or not. But Europe is old. Some of the parts of it were so worn, the stones were rounded. I went to many of the churches in the time that I was there with people who were French or German, who took me there to their churches. And the streets are so narrow that you couldn't get two cars by them. So it'd be one at a time. I was very surprised to see such terrible desolation throughout. I got to cities where there wasn't anything alive. It was nothing but rubble, cats, and other pests like rats. And I made trips around when I had time off with my buddies to some of these places. The most surprising was Köln, where the church was targeted as not to hit. And it was my privilege to see that. The windows were all broken, but the church was untouched. All around it was rubble. Cologne.
I thought you said Curlin, but I've heard that story about Cologne.
Because the German word is K-O-U-M-L-A-U-T. Curlin is the way they pronounce it, but it's Cologne.
So you're talking about the famous church in Cologne that was left standing.
Yes.
What did that teach you about humanity, and what kind of perspective did it give you on what matters and what doesn't?
War is hell. War is useless. You never get anywhere in a war. The only thing you get is fewer people. And it's a crime and a sin against humanity to have a war.
When you came back to the States, you finished up at Cal, doubling as the president of your fraternity, ATO, and something tells me you might be the oldest living member of that fraternity there in Berkeley. And Uncle Sam paid for all of it thanks to the GI Bill. I bet that's something that you're pretty thankful for.
Well, I have double thank you. The first thank you is ASTP. That is much more valuable to me than anything else I ever did in my life, because that was 1 year of education with the people that knew, and those people were so kind. I was having a little trouble with math, so I was told by the math prof, who was Francis Mayle Bacon, he said, "What's the matter?" I said, "Well, I'm having trouble catching up. I have not been doing any math for the last 3 months. By the way, I was in industry for a year or so after the war broke out, before I got drafted." So Dr. Bacon, he said, "So you're having trouble. What kind of trouble?" I explained to him where I was and all. He says, "Well, how about coming over to my house tonight?" So I went over to his house, and he had dinner for me and had a blackboard. And from there on, math became easy.
And it sounds like it factored heavily in the rest of your career as well. You mentioned one of the projects that you worked on later on, the defense-related system. What are some of the other things that you take pride in your post-war exploits?
I did many microelectronic things. I was interested in electronic packaging. I worked on a thin film laboratory as manager of the laboratory for General Dynamics. Thin film means silicon wafers on which you deposit transistors and circuits. And that's how come today we have integrated circuits. I became the leader of EIA, Electronic Industries Association, first group to write standards for analog integrated circuits. And all the greats in the business, like Motorola and Fairchild, Texas Instrument, all these were part of the group who wrote those standards. And I had the privilege of leading that group.
Quite a privilege indeed. I've got to ask you, in those days, and we're talking about decades ago, did you foresee how far it's come now and the amount of technology and computing power that we can hold in our hand?
I did. As a matter of fact, I still look forward to a time when most of this will be, instead of having to do the labor of producing them, being able to think what you want to see and have it occur.
You're blowing people's minds right now. Do you really think that's possible?
I do.
How far away do you think we are?
20 years.
So in 20 years, we won't need that phone in our hand. We'll just be able to think someone's number, or they might not even need a number. Think someone's name and you can see them.
The brain is where we are going. Right now, the United States has put money into brain research recently, and some of that is resulting in investigations electronically and investigations visually. And I think that we will get to a point where we can think something and have it materialize.
Is that a place worth going? You talked about writing the standards for your industry. Is there some danger in technology that is to that level?
You bet. All kinds of dangers. We'll have to work on how to protect ourselves. Today we're having similar problems. Let's put it this way. ISIS can bring a plane down, and they don't have to do very much work to do it. We have to find a way to stop that. But to think of systems that are being designed today, the brain can help to get there easier.
Well, clearly you have a very active and healthy brain, and you're 95 and a half years old. What's your secret? How do you stay so youthful and sharp?
Just lucky, that's all.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country in a very unique way. Thank you for sharing a few of your stories with us. In closing, when you think back on that time that really did shape the world during World War II and changed all of our futures, some of us wouldn't be here, like myself. What do you think is important for those of us who weren't around to remember and understand about that time in our nation's history?
I would suggest that they just look on it as a lesson to avoid any kind of war. Learn how to get along with people. One-to-one is the beginning of how to get along with people, so you don't have these groups of people who hate each other and wind up killing each other because that's their solution to the arguments that they get into and can't get out of.
Well, and I can't let you go without getting the kind of story that it seems almost every veteran has, that one decision, that one break, a twist of fate, whatever you want to call it, where it could have been your name counted among the more than 406,000 Americans who died during World War II.
I was about to board a train that was going to a POE to go to the Japanese theater. We had trained in that, if anybody trained in that team, they were to remain in that team wherever they went. That was a commitment that the War Department made with AT&T. It took a lot of training to get the people to know how to repair it, fix it, operate it, and make it go. So this train was to take the whole company of 200 men and take them to the Japanese theater or to the Pacific.
And you went to board that train.
I was on the train and ready to take off with one other friend who was equally trained. About the time the train was to leave, an orderly came down the road and looked for me and this other person. And he says, "Is Corporal Sawyer here somewhere?" "Yes, here I am." "You're not allowed to go. You're to stay here." That's what he said. "So get off the train." So I did.
Were you a little upset about that?
I was very upset. I was losing all my buddies, and I was going to have to do something. I had no idea what was going to happen. Besides, the camp was empty, except for the two of us. So the train took off. I was then sent to the East Coast to put a team together to go to Europe. It turns out, as I heard it, and this is not necessarily proven, but I heard that the entire crew that was on that train was on a ship that was sunk shortly after it left port. And I'd like to know whether that really happened or not, but it gave me a shock that I cannot today really get over.
And that was 70 years ago, and you would have been on that ship. How do you account for you being the one guy that they came on the train and pulled off?
Well, that was the commitment made between AT&T and the government. They spent a lot of time and money training these people to operate equipment which was new and mysterious to others, so that they would want guarantee that their equipment would be operated by people who knew how.
So you don't assign any kind of divine intervention in that moment, just the deal that was made was actually honored.
There is a religious aspect to it, which I will not really blame or thank, but I do thank my God for the way things worked out for me. Not just that, but for many other incidents in the whole story. And I really was unhappy that I didn't go with that bunch, but I was willing to accept what was given to me.
One of the things that I say quite a bit if I go speak to people, because it's the way I see the world and what's been hammered into my head by the way things have unfolded, is that God's plans are always better than my plans. It kind of sounds like that's what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely so. No question about it. And there are many other incidents in my life that are similar to that. When I was studying for this radio transmitter, one of the teachers was an employee of the CIA, and they were looking for people to serve in a suicide group to go to one of the Pacific Islands with equipment in order to be able to communicate with that island while the Japanese were still on it, and that person would be there until he was killed by the Japanese. That situation did not work out, but that person from the CIA, I knew and met him after the war, and he told me that story. At the time, I had no idea what they were planning.
So there was a point in time where if you had so chosen, you could have been on that suicide mission?
Exactly so.
What made you take a different path?
God. That and many other things like it in my life have happened, and I thank my Lord for the way I was treated.
Well, I'm thankful for the chance to spend this hour with you, and I trust our audience feels the same way. Houghton Sawyer, 95 years old, taking us back in time and also giving us a glimpse of the future as he sees it. We're out of time today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.